when the introduction of harder drugs into the drug food chain had a major impact on the trade and the relative prosperity of those now coming into prison. These new Cape Flats gangsters had no desire to be systematically raped as wifeys by members of the numbers in Polesmore, funnily enough, and having the money to buy themselves out of it promptly did so. As a result, they became de facto members of the Polesmore gang, and once released, took numbers, traditions and ideology with them back to the flats. As far as South Africa's gang culture was concerned, Polesmore was its beating, corrupted heart. I've talked about my visit there, see J's for John Mungrel, but suffice to say that it fully deserves its place in my A to Z of hell. Back in the Cape Flats, and I began hearing more about some of the gangs. The Sexy Boys, the Hard Livings, the Dixies, the Ghetto Boys, and of course the two biggest, the Firm and the Americans. It was in the Cape Flats that I met Kevin, a member of the Americans gang, who took me to meet some fellow gang members. The base? Where else would the Americans meet but at the White House? Not nearly as salubrious as its Washington namesake, the Cape Flats White House was a low, timber-built building with a corrugated iron roof that had been painted white. Inside it were low ceilings, a Stars and Stripes flag hanging on the wall, various US-style souvenirs, and some very careworn seating. No Oval Office, though, as far as I can remember. Instead, there was a group of Americans gang members who were, well, what's a polite way of saying this, already in an advanced state of refreshment, perhaps? Why? They were smoking crystal meth, which in Cape Town is known as teak. Crystal meth use in South Africa has exploded during the past decade. Until around 2003, the drug was virtually unknown. Now it's Cape Town's main hard drug. What users do, indeed what my new mates in the White House were doing, is take it by removing the metal and filament parts from a light bulb, then heating the glass and stretching it out to form a pipe. Into the pipe goes the crystal meth, which looks like crushed glass, and in fact is often called glass for that very reason. The user heats up the pipe, inhales the smoke, and that's it. Job done. One crystal meth hit. Now, the crystal meth high is a big up high. So what my guys were doing was leveling off with a mix of marijuana and the sedative Mandrax. They packed the neck of a broken beer bottle with marijuana and crushed up Mandrax pills, mixed the whole lot together, set it alight, and inhaled. So, in one toke, crystal meth, up. In the next toke, Mandrax marijuana, down. I mean, Christ only knows how that felt. It must have been like going up and down Canary Wharf in a broken lift for hours on end. Up, down, up, down. And God knows how they did it. But some of the gang members were actually able to hold a conversation in this state, and we began the interview. It was a tiny room. A fog of smoke literally hung in the air, and though it doesn't show up so well on the film, the whole time it felt like I was squinting at the gang members through a layer of fog. It also meant that every time I opened my mouth to speak, I was getting a generous dose of secondary smoke. That oh-so-intoxicating mix of crystal meth, marijuana, and Mandrax. You got it. I was getting accidentally shit-faced. Still, the interview went on. One of the main topics of conversation was the ethnicity of the gang members. The Americans were not white, but nor were they black. They were what's known in South Africa as Cape Coloureds, which in that particular society is at the bottom of the ladder, or so they thought. In their eyes was the resentment of ages. I asked them what they thought the future held for them, and they had no answer. Watching them squabble over modified light bulbs and broken beer bottles used as drug receptacles, you couldn't help but think their options were a little on the limited side. Some of the gang talked fluidly, tongues loosened by the tick. Others sat almost comatose, watching me. One in particular was a budgerigar, and... Wait a second. A budgerigar? I blinked to try and clear my head. You've got to bear in mind that these guys were hardened, habitual crystal meth users. Me? I had no tolerance for this stuff. Even the relatively tiny amount I was inhaling was getting me off my face. Also, bear in mind that even though the interview lasts about 5 minutes on screen, we did the audience a favour and cut out hours' worth of the gang members smoking drugs, squabbling over drugs, surfing hits and talking absolute gibberish. In order to get the 5 minutes of usable film you see on screen, I was in the White House for 3 hours. The sound man, Jeff Hodd, and cameraman Craig Matthew took breaks and went outside, so they weren't so badly affected. Me, on the other hand. Much later, when we reviewed the footage, we realized that by the end of the sessions, the gang's members really were talking gibberish. Complete nonsense. At the time, though, I didn't realize. That's because I was talking gibberish too. Not only that, but the gang members were continuing to morph into birds. In some cases, it was an improvement. But even so, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't a welcome development. Looking across the room, I could see Jeff and Craig looking unwell too. No doubt about it, it was time to beat a retreat, so we stopped filming and thanked the guys for their time. I got to my feet on unsteady legs, and we staggered to the door and out into the fresh air and sunshine. Outside, we tried to do a piece to camera, but it was a complete non-starter, and we never used it. Instead, there's a shot of me staggering away from the White House. Have a look at it. I got into the car, returned to the hotel at 12:30 p.m., scoffed scones and jam, drank a litre of water, then went to bed, and wasn't seen again for 24 hours. X is for extremely bloody cold. In a lot of the places I've travelled to, heat was the problem. And when I think of the hottest I've ever been, I think of that night in the Congo, or in the tunnels in the Gaza Strip. But when I think of the coldest I've ever been, what comes to mind is Afghanistan, funnily enough, when I swear I nearly got hypothermia. We were with the Royal Anglian, and went out with B Company on what turned out to be a 16-hour yomp through some of the toughest territory the country has to offer. And take it from me, Afghanistan has some very tough territory to offer. Because you're wearing so much gear, your helmet, your body armor, your backpack, you sweat like I don't know what. So as night fell and it began to get cold, our temperatures plummeted. Even so, we needed to rest, so we lay down in a maize field, trying to forget that the Afghans fertilized their fields with their own feces, and began to feel our sweat-soaked clothes chill our flesh. And we started to get cold. I mean, really cold. Afghanistan has the most diverse temperatures, and here we were at the real bottom end of it. The lot of us began to shiver violently in the shit-smelling maize field. We wanted to sleep, but falling asleep was dangerous, because when you're that cold, you can slip into a coma. Even so, and even shivering so hard in my clothes, I felt myself begin to doze. Kick. A boot right in the side woke me up. Squaddies were going round kicking us to make sure we stayed awake. Starting to feel sleepy. Kick! Believe me, a squaddy boot in the ribs is better than any alarm clock. Beginning to doze. Kick! After a while we gathered ourselves and took off again, and I reflected that in war you can have all the high-tech gear you want, but at the end of the day what really matters is squaddies kicking you awake. It's the guys on the ground looking out for each other that really counts. Y is for, you don't want to do that, mate. Our time in the Gaza Strip had been memorable for all kinds of reasons, not least our narrow brush with death at the PRC hideout in Nigella's kitchen. See, B is for be careful where you... Oops, too late. Little did we know, there was more to come. It was our last day, but as we headed for the border, we received a call from a military faction called the Al-Nasser Brigade, the military wing of the Popular Resistance Committee. They'd requested a meeting with us. We wondered why. The Al-Nasser Brigade claimed responsibility for bombings in Israel. But apart from that, and knowing that they'd been formed in 2000 and included ex-members of Hamas and Fatah, we knew nothing about them and had no idea what they wanted. Kidnapping? Trap? Loads of possibilities crossed our minds, including the one that we decided to go with, that they just wanted to put forward their side of the story. The day came, and we were greeted by two guys carrying AK-47s before our little Nissan van was taken on a magical mystery tour that ended with us stopping at the side of a road. A number of masked men with RPGs met us, then ushered us out of the car and across some dry land towards what looked like a shaded area that turned out to be an orchard. Again, my greatest concern was not necessarily what these guys might do to us, but what the eyes in the sky might be seeing and what the Israeli response might therefore be. And there, in the orchard, was a suicide bomber. And let me tell you, there was no doubt whatsoever that he was a suicide bomber. He wore a balaclava and a vest full of explosives. In his hand, he held a little trigger that was wired to the vest, and he was oddly detached, yet all the while maintaining a great dignity, which was no mean feat considering that he wore a suicide vest packed with explosives. His comrades pointed a video camera his way, and I realized why we'd been brought here. It was to witness the making of a martyr video. "I am a living martyr, committed to this task to satisfy God for my country." I couldn't help but notice that he was fiddling with his trigger as he spoke. And then, when he'd finished the video and I began interviewing him, he was still fiddling with the trigger. He was a university graduate, he told me, with his finger on the trigger, and his family had been killed. My eyes went from his hand to the explosives. Everything seemed to be attached. I asked him if what he was doing would increase or decrease violence. He seemed quite exasperated as he answered, "They are attacking my country, and I must defend it in any way possible." He fiddled with the trigger. "Did he know there were Israelis who wanted peace?" I asked him. "Of course, I support peace, but my country is occupied," he told me. "War brings war. Peace brings peace." I have to say that I breathed a sigh of relief when the interview finally ended, and with half an eye on the trigger, I thanked him and left, not at all sad to be getting back to the relative safety of the car. His detachment had been unsettling. I had little doubt that, given the chance, he would achieve his goal. Z is for zebra crossings, or whatever the equivalent is, in Venezuela. We were in Venezuela for the second series of Extreme World, which just so happened to be the first series produced by my new production company, Freshwater, so holds a special place in my heart. Not that this has anything to do with using zebra crossings in Venezuela, you understand. I just thought I'd mention it. No, the point about not using zebra crossings in Venezuela is that Venezuela is a country, much like any other, of haves and have-nots. But what marks it out is how willing the haves are to trample on the have-nots, and how far the have-nots are prepared to effect a change in their personal fortunes. One of the main objectives of making the film was to get access to the Venezuelan prison controlled by Leo. See, P is for a prostitute called Margarita, and that meant staying in Caracas. At the time of our filming, statistically the most violent capital city on the planet, which meant we had the pleasure of a very nice hotel. For a socialist utopia, there are some very nice hotels in Caracas. Now, on this particular day, I looked out of my window and saw a local guy crossing the road at a pedestrian crossing below. To my horror, I saw that even though he seemed to have right of way, a car shot the crossing and knocked him down. Fortunately, the car wasn't going fast, and relaxing slightly, I could see he was only stunned. What's more, there were men rushing out of the car that had knocked him down and going to his aid. Only, I realized that the occupants of the car weren't trying to help the poor bugger at all. In fact, with practiced speed and skill, They went through his pockets, grabbing anything of value, finally taking his gold Rolex off him, before dropping him and jumping back into the car, reversing and roaring off. It was all over in a few seconds. Dazed, the poor bloke on the floor picked himself up and made his way to safety, and I shook my head thinking that now I'd seen it all. But I hadn't. The next day I saw exactly the same thing happen again. Different victim, of course, and different thieves, too, but exactly the same M.O. That zebra crossing, I gave it a wide berth after that, and I wondered, was it a crash point or a cash point? Z is also for I think I've already mentioned that we used to have a saying out in Afghanistan, he who sleeps first sleeps longest. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have an appointment with an infected blue mattress, a cuddly toy, a tin of tuna, and a lucky ducky. That is the end of A to Z of Hell, Ross Kemp's How Not to Travel the World. It was written by Ross Kemp and read by Mark Meadows. This has been an ISIS Audiobooks presentation.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.